The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
What do the literary giants T.S. Eliot, Henry Miller, and Alfred Perlis have in common? The answer is that they were all mentors of today's subject, author Lawrence Durrell. In 1957, Lawrence Durrell published the book Justine, the first of four novels known as the Alexandria Quartet.
Radioscopie.
Lawrence Durrell.
Jacques Chancel.
The next piece came after many, many talks in cafes between Henry Miller and Lawrence Durrell about our writing. We nurtured and encouraged each other greatly, but we also had differences.
Oh, I got something rather urgent I wanted to
all
ask
right,
you.
All right, good. I couldn't
sleep last night.
Yeah.
And I took that book about suicide up to bed, and I remembered all our conversations. And I wondered, is suicide, or the desire for, a young man's feeling, or an elderly man? Does one feel more and more suicidal, or less and less as one goes on? I was more at 20 and less now at 50.
Same with me, yeah. But it doesn't last as long.
Every Wednesday now in the winter, I lunch with Antrobus at his club, picking him up at the Foreign Office just before noon. Yesterday, his memory carried him back to Bulgaria again, where he had served under Pope Mowbray and over de Mandeville as head of chancery. Bitter days, he mused.
This is Roscoe Lee Brown reading pages 138 to 161 from Durrell's Mount Olive.
This is June Foray reading Balthazar, pages 99 to 120.
This is Julie Christie reading from Justine, pages 173 to 188.
The passion of their embraces came from complicity, from something deeper, more wicked than the wayward temptings of the flesh or the mind.
You might think this year is all about Dickens, but think again. It's also the 100th anniversary of the birth of Lawrence Durrell. He was a prolific writer, though not quite as prolific as Dickens, who regarded himself foremost as a poet, but is best known for his novels, of which I counted 17. He was a friend and admirer of Aeneas Nin and Henry Miller, as you've just heard, and admired himself as an author of world renown. For the anniversary, Faber, his main publisher, which naturally shares his assessment of himself, has brought out a new edition of his Alexandria Quartet, which was published between 1957 and 1960. This version is introduced by travel writer Jan Morris. So I asked Jan Morris why she was chosen.
Well, I suppose partly because I was concerned with the Middle East for a long part of my life, and partly because I write books about places, and these particular books are associated with a particular place in the Middle East.
Uh-huh. Did you know him personally?
Well, I only knew him in later life when he was living in Cyprus and working for the British Information Service, something like that. I met him then and had several conversations with him. That's about it. I remember his saying that it was better to be his brother than to be him, because his brother was selling vast quantities of books about animals. Do you remember?
Yes, of course. My family and other animals, which yes, I've read to my children all these years on.
Yes.
It was a period when there were quite a few writers drifting around the Mediterranean being rather glamorous. You were one of them, weren't you, and Robert Graves. And I wondered how Lawrence Durrell fitted into that as a character.
I didn't think that he seemed a very remarkable man when I met him. As a matter of fact, I thought he seemed rather ordinary. And we talked about the sort of thing that professional writers do talk about publishers, you know, about royalties, about how our books were doing. I didn't think of him then as being a sort of visionary, which I do see now. He must have been.
There is some ambivalence in your introduction. You describe the florid vulgarities and the modernist pretensions, no less, of the Alexandria Quartet.
Yes, so in that particular instance, I was really quoting what other people said. Mm-hmm. But I do have an ambivalent feeling about it anyway. as I said at the end of the introduction, when I said I thought he was, on the whole, a masterpiece.
Yeah, I spotted that. So go on, talk about the bit that is the masterpiece, and then tell us about some of the flaws. Or maybe you should do it the other way around.
Clearly it is a masterpiece of some sort or other, a very unusual one, but the whole of it is a most extraordinary achievement. It's full of most beautiful things, and full, to my mind, of rather silly things. But the whole of it is what counts, really. You can read a bit of even one of these books, I suppose, and come away thinking the whole thing was nonsense and pretentious nonsense at that. But if you read the whole work, you could hardly leave it without thinking that you've come across something rather great in the history of literature.
Regarde d'Arezois, says Justine. How is it you are so much one of us and yet you are not? She is combing that dark head in the mirror, her mouth and eyes drawn up about a cigarette. You are a mental refugee, of course, being Irish, but you miss our angoisse. What she's groping after is really the distinctive quality which emanates not from us, but from the landscape, the metallic flavours of exhaustion which impregnate the airs of Mariottis. As she speaks, I am thinking of the founders of the city, of the soldier god in his glass coffin, the youthful body lapped in silver, riding down the river towards his tomb, or of that great square negro head reverberating with the concept of God conceived in the spirit of pure intellectual play, Plotinus. It is as if the preoccupations of this landscape were centred somewhere out of reach of the average inhabitant, in a region where the flesh, stripped by overindulgence of its final reticences, must yield to a preoccupation vastly more comprehensive, or perish in the kind of exhaustion represented by the works of Musa, the guileless playing of hermaphrodites in the green courtyards of art and science. Poetry is a clumsy attempt at the artificial insemination of the muses. Ah, said Justine once, that there should be something free, something Polynesian about the license in which we live. Or even Mediterranean, she might have added, for the connotation of every kiss would be different in Italy or Spain. Here our bodies were chafed by the harsh, desiccated winds blowing up out of the deserts of Africa, and for love we were forced to substitute a wiser but crueler mental tenderness, which emphasised loneliness rather than expurgated it.
Is it about its evocation of place that this greatness lies?
I suppose, for me anyway, it probably is, because I have always been concerned with the spirit of place, and indeed have made my living by trying to evoke the spirit of place. So the chord that it strikes with me is very largely the fact that it deals in a visionary way with a particular city at a particular time.
Capitally, what is this city of ours? What is resumed in the word Alexandria? In a flash, my mind's eye shows me 1,000 dust-tormented streets. Flies and beggars own it today, and those who enjoy an intermediate existence between either. 5 races, 5 languages, 12 creeds. 5 fleets turning through their greasy reflections behind the harbour bar. But there are more than 5 sexes, and only demotic Greek seems to distinguish among them. The sexual provender which lies to hand is staggering in its variety and profusion. You would never mistake it for a happy place. The symbolic lovers of the free Hellenic world are replaced here by something different, something subtly androgynous, inverted upon itself. The Orient cannot rejoice in the sweet anarchy of the body, for it has outstripped the body. I remember Nesim once saying, I think he was quoting, that Alexandria was the great winepress of love. Those who emerged from it were the sick men, the solitaries, the prophets. I mean, all who have been deeply wounded in their sex.
because I was in Alexandria in the... it's a totally different city, really, now. Because the time he was writing about, which was after the Second World War, was the last years of Levantine Alexandria, of cosmopolitan Alexandria, which was a city of infinite variety, obviously marvellous historical origins, but a remarkable presence too, because it was inhabited by people from countless nationalities, all mixed up in the most confusing and interesting way. It was a sensual sort of city. Everybody felt that. It wasn't exactly sexual for everybody, but it was sensual in the sense that it appealed to one's senses in an indefinable way. And that is what I think Darrell does so brilliantly in these books. It's the intangible, indefinable spell of this particular city on the cusp between Europe and Asia and Africa, I mean, and on the cusp between a historical past and a very remarkable present that makes the city, did make the city unique, really, among cities. It was one of a kind, and these books are themselves, the trilogy is one of a kind.
Now, there's quite a lot of sex in it, sexuality in it. You make the distinction, he made the distinction between sexuality and pornography.
I didn't understand half the sex in it, as a matter of fact. It isn't pornographic. There are no pornographic scenes. But the suggestions in it are, I suppose, decidedly pornographic and certainly very sexual. The numberless sexual encounters which it evokes in the book without actually defining what they are. So sometimes, for myself, I'm not certain who is making love to whom.
Yes.
But the whole of it gives you a general impression of sexual activity and excitement.
There's a debate in the first novel, Justine, about whether she's a nymphomaniac, which seems to tie in, for me, with your point. You make the point about it being essentially an existential novel.
And the characters, you know, although they're very well defined, not least Justine, of course, who's the title of the whole thing, really, though they are well defined, they are nevertheless sort of nebulous. They're kind of allegorical figures themselves, so that you can't quite pin them down, just as I personally can't quite pin down what they're up to. But that is part of the fascination of it. And Justine herself, whose figure drifts through the whole trilogy in an ethereal sort of way, we still don't quite know what she's up to at the end of the whole book, or what she is, or what she's like. She remains a kind of shimmering vision, which is part of the nature of the whole work.
Now, you describe it as an experimental novel of its day, and it's obviously a book that exists at a point in history as well as a reissue. Can you remember when you first read it and how it struck you?
I must say that these books, at the time when they came out, I read them avidly. I was very excited by them then. And I read them more or less as I would read a sort of thriller, I suppose.
Yes, you make a really interesting point that he thought he was doing a James Joyce, and actually you think, in a way, he's doing a John le Carré.
Well, yes, I thought perhaps it's going a bit too far. Perhaps it's a bit of each, really. But they can be read as a thriller, and I think when I first read them, I did read them as a sort of thriller, certainly as a straightforward narrative novel, and with great enjoyment and pleasure, I must say. But not least, of course, because the descriptive parts can be so very beautiful.
The flip side of them being beautiful is that they're florid.
I do find them florid too, yes, of course. And, of course, they're a little tiny bit dated, you know. I can't see people writing them in quite that manner now. But they were, sometimes, they really do go over the top, I think, with their absurd floridities. And their deliberate opacities too, which can be annoying, you know, like sort of mock footnotes, things of that kind.
He had spiritual pretensions, didn't he?
That slightly goes over my head, as it went over my head then. I think I really don't understand all the analogies that people put with Freudian psychology, for example.
How do you feel it's lasted?
As a basic level, I think it's lasted very well and will always be read, I feel sure. But I think more and more people, nevertheless, will find parts of it absurd, which I suppose, I must say, I didn't find them absurd when I first read them, and I do now find parts of it downright silly, actually, and I think probably people always will, more so as the centuries go by. Nevertheless, the work itself is really such a great idea and is executed really with such remarkable skill, technical skill and imagination, that I feel sure people will still be reading them 100 years from now.
Jan Morris, keeping her faith in Lawrence Durrell, just. But I bet she never heard him singing jazz to his own accompaniment. This recording is from 1935.
You of a kind, like matter and mind. You can be cruel, I can be kind. But I could never hope to find somebody like you.
The track from a new CD in the British Library's Spoken Word series devoted to archive recordings of Durrell, both in interview and reading from his poems.
At the doors of Africa, so many towns founded upon a parting could become Alexandria, like the wife of Lot, a metaphor for tears. And the queer student in his pokey, hot, 10th-floor room above the harbour hears the sirens shaking the tree of his heart and shuts his books, while the most inexpressible longings like wounds unstitched stir in him some girl's unquiet ghost.
I wanted to use love in a much more all-embracing way, L-O-V-E, L-U-V. I wanted it to be sacred and profane, and I also wanted, too, to try and make an imaginative junction between loving and seeing as a way of seeing the world. Our notions of love so confused, there should be 100 words for the varieties of it, and the richest of European languages has about 4. And yet there are millions of varieties of this strange plant, and it extends, its roots extend from metaphysics to the function of filth on the other.
Night falls, the dark expresses roll back their iron scissors to commence precision of the wheel's elision, from whose dark serial jabber sparks swing swaying through the mournful capitals. And in these lighted cages sleep with open eyes the passengers, each committed to his private folly, on hinges of wan hope, the long sleeping shelves of men and women, a library of maggots dreaming rolls. This is how it is for me. For you it must be different, lying awake to hear at a garden's end the terrible clubfoot crashing among iron spars, the female shrieks, love song of steel and the consenting night.
Now, of course, we all know of one of your great maestros, Miller.
In spite of the fact that we disagree from a literary point of view about almost everything, and we have no authors we admire in common, his Tropic of Cancer woke me up in a funny sort of way. The obscenities seemed healthy. Rabelais was the only person I could think of before that who made you laugh, and where the obscenity seemed rather joyous and not at all fuggy. And Miller seemed to do the same sort of thing. He performed the same service for me in Tropic of Cancer, rid me of that kind of prurient looking-over-your-shoulder attitude. And I had to try and find myself. It was thanks largely to his book that I succeeded.
Solitude is all very well.
Sleep. Napkins folded after grace. Veins of stealing water by the unplumbed ruins, never finding peace. A watershed, a valley of tombs, never finding peace. Look, she might say, press here with your fingers at the temples. Are they not the blunt, uncut horns of the small, naked Ionian fauns? Much later, moving in a dark, snow-lit landscape softly, in her small frock walked his daughter, and a simile came into his mind of lovers like swimmers lost at sea, exhausted in each other's arms, urgent for land, but treading water.
Every tick-tock of the grandfather clock said, you're wasting your life, you young man. Try and find her, then remind her. If you possibly can,
So how do you think of Lawrence Durrell? I wonder how many of you aged under 40 have ever even read him. We have one of them here, captive, Sam Jordison. Do even his contemporaries still rate him as highly as they once did? Or are they, like Jan Morris, possessed of a certain ambivalence? Joining us now as well is Joanna Hodgkin, the daughter of Durrell's long-suffering first wife, who has written a new book about his marriage to her mother. Joanna, you tell quite a shocking story in Amateurs in Eden.
I suppose it is quite shocking. I grew up with it, so it wasn't shocking to me. But my mother, when she realised she was going to be written about in all the sort of Durrell biographies and things, wanted her side of the story to be told. So that's what I've tried to do. I've tried to do it as honestly as I could. And if it's shocking, then that is because of the material. But, I mean, in a way, it gives a portrait of him as a young husband not doing very well and not being a terribly good young husband. But I hope it also gives an idea of him as a passionate writer and someone who put his writing first.
Now, he called her a lamppost and the slut. He really wasn't very nice to her, was he?
I think he was one of those people who, when he was in an argument, just wanted to win at all costs. So he brought out everything he had and flung it at her. I mean, the lamppost was because she was about 5 inches taller than him and she was very thin. So I think that could have been quite affectionate. Slut is not so affectionate, it has to be said.
There were quite a lot of nice anecdotes about his attitude to his height, weren't there? Some of them apocryphal, some of them probably did happen, such as, did he really hire circus dwarfs to be the witnesses at their wedding?
Well, if he did, there's no backup information about this. I imagine, I mean, he always said, and he would tell his biographers these wonderful tall stories, which they wrote down very carefully. My mother never mentioned it, and I think if there had been circus dwarves at the wedding to make him look taller, she would have remembered that.
At what point did you get to read your mother's reminiscences of him? Because this was happened before you were born. You were the child of her second marriage.
Yes. Well, she talked about him a lot. She talked about him when I was a child. She talked about Corfu a lot, because in a way, a lot of this, the Eden that they discovered was Corfu before the war. So she talked about that. I'd seen the tapes that she made before she died with my father, and I suppose I'd looked at some of the memoir that she'd written, but truth to tell, I wasn't that interested at the time. It was only when I started to sort of think of it as a story that I suddenly got gripped by the story, and so I came to it quite fresh in a way, which I think helped.
Sam, I'm going to bring you in here. You are, as I have already announced, under 40, and therefore you have to account for yourself liking this writer. And but you are also lead our reading group, and you're about to embark on a whole month of reading Lawrence Durrell. In fact, the Alexandria Quartet, aren't you?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And yeah, as an under 40-year-old, it's quite a coincidence that I came across Lawrence Durrell, really. I only knew about him from My Family and Other Animals, where he's this kind of quite crazy blonde firework, I think he's called, always lecturing his sister about free love and inflicting his incredibly highbrow friends on the long-suffering mother character. It was only a coincidence I picked up one of his books in a foreign language bookshops once, because there wasn't much else in English. And this was Monsieur, one of his later books. And at first it seemed like an incredibly difficult, impenetrable read. It was a really strange story to start off with people eating mummy flesh, followed by kippers, I think. And there were stories within stories and books within books, and this was only the first part of a series. And there were all kinds of words that were hard to understand, even Spigian he used, for instance. And, it took me a long time to get into it, but even though it was all but impenetrable at first, there's a kind of a strange magic that really pulls you in. And by the end, I was completely entranced and then moved on to what was once a series of books that everyone would read, and now hardly anyone reads, the Alexandrian Quartet, which is completely magical and incredibly wonderful. And it is, baroque and over the top and extremely passionate. And, it seems out of step, perhaps, with the kind of reading that most people do today, but that only adds to its power as far as I'm concerned. And I'm hoping with the reading group to introduce more people to this and to spread the word about someone who should be remembered as as one of Britain's best writers from the 20th century, but is in danger of being forgotten.
But most of your other reading group choices have been short, haven't they? A lot of them. I mean, things like Fahrenheit 451 and Don't Look Now. This is an absolute stonker to land them with. I mean, they're going to do all four novels, are you?
That's the hope, yeah. And I think it is really important to do all four novels because they connect together in such interesting ways. And also, you realise, I don't want to give too much away because it's one of the great, wonderful surprises in the series, that everything gets turned on its head and everything's changed. So the first book, Justine, is written in what he later jokes, he builds a Taj Mahal of adjectives and flurries of references and everything around everything he talks about, and it's full of passionate intensity and exaggerated feeling almost. And whilst that's entrancing, you're always thinking as you're reading it, kind of, you know, steady on, this is slightly over the top. And as you get to the later books, you realise that the, you know, the richness and the sensuousness and the fact that it is so thick and treacly is actually deliberately done for effect. And it's a reflection not on Durrell so much as what emerges as a very confused and confusing character.
It's not to everybody's taste, but if it is to your taste, you will absolutely love it. And it will, for a lot of people, it was life-changing when they read it in the late 50s, early 60s. And I think it probably, you know, for some people it could be again. I didn't read it until I came to write the book, so I read it a couple of years ago. And I have to say that for me, what's wonderful about him is his poetry and his lyric writing and his descriptions. So the island books are the things that I love. And I think no one should visit Greece without one of his island books in their luggage. The Alexandria Quartet, in a way, it didn't do it for me, but I've met so many people who just saw it as a sort of Damascus Road. It changed their lives and forever.
I think another really interesting influence of Lawrence Durrell, which is kind of counterintuitive, is Raymond Carver, who, in a sense, is the anti-Lawrence Durrell with his, you know, really compact short stories, famously sparse sentences, and, you know, things are never directly addressed, they're alluded to, whereas Lawrence Durrell will write great volumes about the power of love and everything else. But Raymond Carver always said that Lawrence Durrell was his favourite writer, and always said that when he was a creative writing teacher, that Lawrence Durrell should be the first person that people turn to.
Oh, by the way, I pronounce it Durrell. Should we have an adjudication? I notice you're pronouncing it Durrell, Sam. Should we have an adjudication from one who knows, Joanna?
She who knows says it's Durrell.
So you're out, boy. let's now move a little bit more into the anecdote. He was great friends. Part of the coterie they were in was Anais Nin and Henry Miller. And Henry Miller, of course, was a lifelong friend of his and also a literary influence. Tell us a little bit about that. Very glamorous, but pretty horrid for your mother.
It was horrid in a way, but she loved Henry Miller and she was fascinated by Anais Nin. So she loved it as well as finding it terribly difficult, because she felt that she was excluded all the time. And one of the fascinating things for me was reading Henry Miller's book, Colossus of Marousi, which is a wonderful, wonderful book, and describes his visit to Greece in 1939 and a trip that the three of them did in the Peloponnese over Christmas 1939. And he describes how Larry, as he called him, excluded other people from their group. There were three of them. And this was Henry Miller, who was 20 years older than him and a very established, tough man. And he said he found himself behind a wall of ice. And I thought, that's where my mother was. She'd actually ended up behind a wall of ice. And if he could do it to Henry Miller in 3 days, it's no wonder that my mother, Nancy, just didn't have a chance after 7 years of being with him. She was well behind her wall of ice, and it took a long time for her to emerge.
Sam, how much do you think Henry Miller's writing, he was the author of Tropic of Capricorn, Tropic of Cancer, among other books, how much influence did he have on Durrell's writing, do you think?
I think, especially early on, a huge influence. If you look at one of his earliest books, and the book that was really his great breakthrough and helped him find his unique voice, The Black Book, you can see the heavy influence of Henry Miller in, you know, in style, and also that tremendous enthusiasm for everything, and, you know, that kind of outrush of words and emotions it's as if he'd kind of, you know, Henry Miller had enabled him to open a valve somewhere and let it all rush out in a similar way. And Anais Nin, again, I mean, it's a bit more difficult to know how much of Anais Nin he would have been able to read, because so much was in her diaries and his early books. The Black Book, again, has got, you know, a lot of what at the time was seen as, you know, strong erotica, and it was banned in the UK. I think it wasn't published until the 1970s, and he lived with Henry Miller and Villa Surat in Paris for a while and was very much involved in that circle.
She did influence him in one of his sort of little-known books, which he first called Christmas Carol, I think, not very originally, and then was renamed Asylum in the Snow. And it's a strange, dreamlike, sort of surrealist thing that was very, very much influenced by a piece that she'd done, that sort of stream of consciousness deeply in the dream world. It's also very, very sensuous. Everything is, I mean, the descriptions of everyday life and the descriptions of light and the descriptions of colour and everything. The eroticism is part of a kind of eroticism of life, in a way.
Yeah,
everything is over the top and highly coloured and stunning. I mean, to read small passages of his stuff, he uses words like no one else. They're wonderful.
That's really true. And Alexandria, in the Alexandria Quartet, becomes a character as much as anyone else, and it is described in these tremendously sensuous physical terms.
So the city claimed me once more, the same city made now somehow less poignant and less terrifying than it had been in the past by new displacements in time. If some parts of the old fabric had worn away, others had been restored. In the first few weeks of my new employment, I had time to experience both a sense of familiarity and one of alienation, measuring stability against change, past against present tense. And if the society of my friends remained relatively the same, new influences had entered, new winds had sprung up. We'd all begun, like those figures on revolving turntables in jewellers' shops, to turn new facets of ourselves towards each other. Circumstances also helped to provide a new counterpoint, for the old, apparently unchanged city had now entered the penumbra of war. For my part, I'd come to see it as it must always have been, a shabby little seaport built upon a sand reef, a moribund and spiritless backwater. True, this unknown factor, war, had given it a specious sort of modern value, but this belonged to the invisible world of strategies and armies, not to ourselves, the inhabitants. It had swollen its population by many thousands of refugees in uniform and attracted those long nights of dull torment which were only relatively dangerous. For as yet, the enemy was confining his operations strictly to the harbour area. Only a small area of the Arab quarter came under direct fire. The upper town remained relatively untouched, except perhaps for an occasional error of judgment. No, it was only the harbour at which the enemy scratched, like a dog at an inflamed scab. A mile away from it, the bankers conducted their affairs by day, as if from the immunity of New York.
Now, how experimental is it?
I think at the time it was very groundbreaking. I mean, it was something completely new and completely different. And it suffered, I think, partly because it was so new and different and then everyone else copied it. And so it doesn't seem very new and different. It's like watching Stagecoach or something, which, you know, was amazing at the time, and everything now has become cliched. But it's worth reading because you kind of get the first pressing, in a way, of this wonderful experiment with points of view and different voices and different realities and all the rest of it. It's, you know, it's a magical world.
One last question to you again, Joanna, is you've dedicated your book, the biography, or at least the portrait of a marriage you describe it as, to your sister, your half-sister.
Well, it's sad because she'd become ill, which was why I started to write the book. And we were thinking that she would need care for some time to come. And with the centenary coming up, we thought, you know, what? And somebody said, who understands about these things, the person who's interesting here is your mother, and no one's ever written about her. Have you ever thought of writing about her? And I said, no. So I started writing the book, and my sister had done a lot of the research, in a way, because she talked to people who knew my mother and who knew them in Palestine and in Alexandria and Cairo and in Greece, and she'd gathered together a lot of material, which I was able to use, but, you know, tragically, she died just as I finished the first draft.
She was Lawrence's daughter?
She was his first child, yes. He had two daughters.
Now, Blake Morrison, reviewing Amateurs in Eden in The Guardian Saturday Review, says it's an enjoyable revisionist account of a bohemian marriage and a smack in the face for Durrell acolytes who think the great man deserved a worthier first mate. So this is a very good thing to read alongside the book itself during the next month. Thank you very much, Joanna and Sam. Well, I hope that's encouraged more of you to try out Lawrence Durrell. Do post your comments as experienced readers or as ingenues. You will find the space under the podcast on this page. If you've come to us through iTunes, the place to go is guardian.co.uk/books and click on the podcast button at the top of the page. We really love having comments from people who've actually listened to the podcast, because quite a few people seem to weigh in there without having done so. Next week, we'll be discussing historical fiction. In the meantime, Alex Blakeman, who's with us on Work Experience, is here to talk us through some of the delights that will be coming up before then.
Our Guardian Book Club podcast with David Lodge is now up on the site. In Saturday Review, the great and the good are nominating their favourite love poems, and we're also calling for our readers to pitch in with theirs.
There'll be the possibility of them being picked as part of an exciting cultural Olympiad project, yet to be announced formally, involving Fiona Shaw, Deborah Warner and Artichoke, the company who brought you street spectaculars such as The Sultan's Elephant. There'll be more news about that shortly.
Still on the subject of love, Sunday's Observer has 10 of the best love letters, as featured in a new British Library anthology, Love Letters, 2000 Years of Romance.
I wonder why they're all being published now. Oh, yes, of course, it's Valentine's Day. Have a good one. My thanks to Jan Morris, Joanna Hodgkin, Sam Jordison, Alex Blakeman, the British Library, and, of course, the ghost of Lawrence Durrell himself. From me, Claire Armistead, and our producer, Tim Mabey, thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.